listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning, I'm Felicia King, and you're listening to Breakfast Bites. This show is part two of auditing your Windows infrastructure. And I'm going to do a little tiny bit of a review of the things that I did cover before, but mostly the intent here with this is that you should listen to this as a kind of a comprehensive show, and then I would definitely encourage you to go back and listen to the second half of part one, which is where this whole topic started, because some of the things that I talked about in that I'm not going to go into as much detail here in this show. All right, so let's start with the common errors and issues that I'm always seem to be finding in organizational infrastructures. And when I'm talking about infrastructures, I'm going to exclusively be focusing on Windows infrastructure as opposed to network design. Network design is a very complex topic by itself, and it should be handled separately. Now, that being said, anyone who tells you that you don't need to understand networking in order to be the master of your Active Directory, I think they're misleading you, because you cannot set up your sites and services and your IP replication objects correctly unless you actually understand how networking infrastructure works. So in the grand scheme of things, if you are responsible for managing a Windows infrastructure, you also have to be pretty savvy about networking as well. And that means also you need to know an awful lot about DNS. When I train IT people, I tell them that the number one thing that will cause your Active Directory to break is problems in DNS. And when your Active Directory is broken, or anything having to do with Active Directory is broken, the first thing that you need to be checking is DNS. You need to make sure that it's correct. So one first thing I do, I look at somebody's Windows infrastructure, is I'm going to go into DNS, and I'm looking for scavenging at both the server level and at the zone level for each individual zone. Zone settings do replicate, but per server settings do not. So if you have 14 domain controllers that are all DNS servers, then you need to be checking each DNS server at the server level settings for server level scavenging. Are the name servers listed for each zone correct? And I reiterate, you've got to check each zone. What about your root hint settings? What about the start authority settings? Are the forwarders for each server set up correctly? Now, forwarders are per server settings, and they do have to be set up for, you know, each server correctly. And you would want to have some sort of consistency in your environment. I don't encourage people to be utilizing different forwarders unless they really have a geographically disparate infrastructure. You could definitely make an argument that says you would use different forwarders for your domain controller in Myanmar than you would for the one in San Francisco. Yes, that's a legitimate argument. Now, beyond that, you really should be checking for all of the SRV records for Active Directory to work properly. Are they there? Do they appear correctly? Things like, you look at the PDC record, the SRV PDC record, is there one there? What about the domains SRV records? There should be an entry for each domain controller. Without going into too much detail in that, there's an article called How DNS Support for Active Directory Works. I will put up a link to it. It really is an excellent article. And it tells you just flat out, verbatim, this is how DNS support for Active Directory works. So you could do a, you know, side-by-side comparison with that article versus your infrastructure. Now, I have had situations where I've been in an environment where DNS was so messed up that the appropriate course of action was just to delete the zone. And I'll tell you this funny little story. So I was working with an IT manager, and the entire infrastructure was just completely messed up. Fortunately, this was a weekend. It was a change window. There weren't any users around. And I just looked at the situation and said, okay, well, it's time to delete all of the DNS zones. Now, the IT manager freaked out a little bit. And it's because she didn't know. She's like, well, can you put them back? And I'm like, of course I can put them back. I got this little script that'll just put them all back. And now, if you're going to do that, so what I'm telling you is the nuclear option is fine if you know what you're doing. So I have this fancy little script that I've got, and I did the deletion of the zones, and you have to be very cognizant of replication storms when you're doing something like this. If your intent is to actually delete the zone, you have to delete it, let that replicate to all of your domain controllers. Then you have to initiate the script that will put the zone and all of its Active Directory supporting configuration back in there. Then you would have to manually re-enter all of the static DNS records that had previously existed. So obviously you would need to have a bit of an inventory for that prior to the deletion process. But then it would replicate again. People can really get themselves into a sticky problem here if they don't have enough patience when they're doing this. So if you've got two domain controllers and they're in different sites, then you do this script on server A where it regenerates the zone, and then you're looking at server B and you're like, stress, stress, the zone's not there, the zone's not there. Well, the zone will eventually be there. Just relax. Okay? It will eventually replicate. Where you can create a problem is if you create the zone on server 2. Yeah, so don't do that, okay? This, of course, is one of those tales of, in general, don't delete enormous things like that unless you really know what you're doing. Oh, speaking of that, is a little bit of an entertainment. Last weekend, I did a project where I actually renamed an Active Directory domain. This is a very challenging project. And the documentation from Microsoft was reasonably good, but not what I would refer to as complete. So this is important because the longer I'm around, I find that, somebody really just caused nothing but a bunch of issues when they concocted a root Active Directory domain name. And they typically used something that was either the same domain externally. They used the Active Directory domain name the same as their external domain, which is usually a bad no-no. So that's a problem. But the other problem is if they use something that was just ridiculously long. So your optimal Active Directory domain name is something that's 3 characters .local, as opposed to something that's 16 characters long and then .local. Now the reason for this is because there are not like an enormous quantity of things, but there certainly are things that have hostname character limits. And if you've sucked up 16 characters with your Active Directory domain name plus .local, then how many characters do you have left for the hostname for your server or anything else? And what if you've got subdomains? Yeah. So the fact remains that Active Directory rename is a pretty significantly high in demand thing that most organizations are going to run into at some point in time or another. The exception to that being large infrastructures that actually had an architect when they designed Active Directory, as opposed to just some dude who worked for them. Yeah. Okay, so moving on is the next thing that I'm looking at when I'm auditing Active Directory is I'm looking at the configuration in sites and services and subnets being defined and that. Now, I talked about that pretty extensively in the part one show, so I'm not going to cover that anymore. However, I will say that you should be checking your replication using the repadmin replsum command. You can also download and install the Active Directory replication status tool on each domain controller, and I will provide you the link to that on my site with this show. You should be looking to determine whether or not auto site coverage is turned on. Usually people do not know to do that. I know to do that because I'm an Active Directory architect. Bridge all site links needs to be turned on. In some rare, insane circumstances, I've seen where somebody thought they were smarter than the KCC, so they actually turned off bridge all site links. And I just sit there and I shake my head and I'm like, what were you thinking? And then I promptly turn it back on. In the last show, I talked about whether or not all of your domain controllers should be global catalog servers, and I went into that in pretty good detail there. So if you're looking for that, revisit part one. You need to look at how your flexible single master operations roles, or otherwise known as the FSMO roles, how those are distributed. They shouldn't all be on one domain controller. If you have five domain controllers at your main facility, and you are that large of an organization, I would put one FSMO role on each one of the five main domain controllers. Split it out. Alternatively, though, I don't think it makes sense to put your infrastructure master role on some remote domain controller. That doesn't make any sense. So you do want to keep them at your local site. Now, there's another interesting little caveat that we have to think about whenever we're talking about these sorts of design factors. And it's now the question of, is that domain controller virtualized or not? This actually has a pretty significant ramification that you may not have considered. If you have a virtualization infrastructure that is super reliable, and you almost never have to reboot your host for the virtualization infrastructure, then you can look at that VM, that domain controller that's a VM, and say, that's actually, in some ways, that might actually be more reliable than a standalone piece of hardware. Whereas, if that VM is a VM on a host server that has to be rebooted for patches, and, you know, it just has to be rebooted once a month, a couple times a month, something like that, then in some ways you could argue that you're actually better off to have the bulk of your FSMO roles on a standalone domain controller. I would always have at least two domain controllers, have them on different pieces of hardware. If you put two domain controllers that are virtual machines on the same host server, I mean, you don't have any redundancy, really. You know, you're just lying to yourself at that point. And if your situation is that you only have one piece of physical hardware, well, then go get an Azure account and set up a branch office VPN and set up a secondary domain controller in Azure. Okay, I mean, at least get some real levels of redundancy and don't just be lying to yourself about the level of redundancy that you have. But something that you have to consider is that member servers and workstations all need to find the domain controller when they boot up. If they don't, they get cranky. So this means that if your primary domain controller is a virtual machine on a host server, and when that host server reboots, all of the other virtual machines on that host server are going to be looking for the domain controller that is also on that host server, then you had better set up boot delays. Alternatively, you could set it up that you have a separate domain controller on another physical piece of hardware, so that one is up, so that when these other VMs boot up, they can actually find a domain controller. So there's a lot of other design considerations that you need to think about when you start virtualizing domain controllers. Next, you need to look at what the OU structure looks like. This is enormous. You should be very cognizant of the fact that there is a dramatic difference between things called containers in Active Directory and OUs, otherwise known as organizational units. If you see a bunch of computer accounts in the computer's container, this should send off alarm bells that somebody has not been doing what they're supposed to be doing with regards to management of things in Active Directory. You cannot apply anything other than the default domain policy or other policies listed literally at the root of the domain to objects that are in the computer's container. So this is very important. The computer's container is meant to be nothing other than a receptacle for new workstations added to the domain when there wasn't a domain-specific routing into a sub-OU setup, which you typically are only going to find at multinational companies. So a standard operating procedure is you add a system to the domain, you then go into the computer's container in Active Directory, you modify the description field appropriately, and then you move that workstation account into the appropriate OU so that it can get the appropriate group policies as designed. So clearly, if you see a bunch of computer accounts in the computer's container, then those things are not getting the group policy that they should probably be getting. So that's one issue that if you find that, that needs to be resolved. The OU structure in general should facilitate good group policy best practices. When you shove all of your users and workstations into the same OU, not a good idea. You should never have users inside the actual user's container or the built-in container in Active Directory. There are containers that are not for, you know, these are for like built-in objects. They are not supposed to be utilized as part of your management structure. So the OU structure is actually very, very important. If you don't have a well-designed OU structure, your group policy will not work properly, or you will end up having to do kludging weird things in order to get things working properly. So next, think about whether or not there's an OU for service accounts. Every infrastructure, and I mean every infrastructure, has a need for service accounts. You should be very careful about what policies are being applied to service accounts. In general, I prefer to have no policies applying to service accounts. And I would want all my service accounts to be in a particular OU so they can be easily identified and managed. Another thing to think about is whether or not your master administrative accounts are excluded from most policies. So, this brings up a whole other interesting point I didn't actually put on the checklist, which is that you really seriously need to audit who has domain admin access. I'm going to put that in the list here so that when you look at the website for this show, you'll actually see this in the checklist. So the reason that you've got to be very concerned about who has domain admin access is because when you see Bob Smith and his regular account, and Bob's the IT manager, and his regular account that he logs onto his workstation with and he does email, when you see that has domain admin access, then alarm bells should be going off. And you should be saying, Bob, this is really horrible. You cannot be browsing the internet and doing emails as your admin account. I mean, come on now. If Bob's browsing the internet and he gets a malvertisement or some sort of worm or Trojan or virus or any sort of nasty thing that gets onto his machine, it's now going to execute with his credentials. And I've seen this happen to people. And it always results in the same level of havoc and destruction. And the havoc and destruction consists typically of infection of other machines, and destruction of data. And the limits to the destruction really has to do with how sophisticated the layered defense strategies on the inside of your network are. So if you have your IT manager set up so that they do not have two different accounts, well, then go slap somebody. Specifically, go slap the IT manager because they should have two separate accounts. They should be doing web browsing and email and that with their non-administrative account, and then they should be doing their server administrative things with strictly their administrative account. And the other ramification of this is that because their user account is a user account, it's going to have policies applied to it. And it's going to have logon scripts and all of that. The admin account that that IT manager has, no way, no how, should there be any policies going on that admin account. Realize that if you are applying user-specific policies to that account, wherever that admin account logs in, it's going to do policy application. I don't think you really want that. If you really want that, well, then you better be darn sure that's what you want and think it through thoroughly and be aware of the ramifications of that. In general, that is not what people desire. Lastly, with regards to domain controllers, I'm very concerned about whether or not the IT manager actually knows what the DS restore mode password is and on each one of the domain controllers, because it could be different. And if they don't know what the DS restore mode password is, well, then you better go reset it. Yeah. And as part of that, you need to very seriously be considering what is your approach for doing an authoritative restore, or for that matter, a non-authoritative restore of Active Directory in the circumstances of a bare metal restore of that domain controller. So this is a huge issue, so I'm going to go into this in a little bit of detail. I oftentimes find where people are saying, oh, but I have backup exec, and backup exec does a system state backup of my domain controller. And I say to them, well, is that actually going to work for you in terms of doing anything other than bare metal restore? They don't know the answer to that. Now, things may have changed a little bit in Active Directory that's installed on Windows Server 2012 R2. And that is because with 2012 R2, as soon as you do a bare metal restore with a system state overlay, it's automatically going to go into a non-authoritative restore. So that's good, because that actually avoids what was previously found to be a very nasty USN rollback condition in Active Directory. However, not everybody has exclusively 2012 R2 domain controllers. So if you have an operating system that is older than that, then you have to be very cognizant of the fact that if you do a bare metal restore, then you need to grab that domain controller immediately and do a non-authoritative restore in DS restore mode, which is why you would have to have your DS restore mode password, and you would have to do a non-authoritative restore of Active Directory. Otherwise, you will create a USN rollback condition. Now, here's the sticky wicket. You're not going to be able to access your backup exec mounted system state backups when you are in DS restore mode. DS restore mode is only going to see system state backups that are made utilizing the native Windows backup tool and that are stored locally. Yes, it is true, you could actually store them on a network location, but I would encourage you to not do that because it can be more trouble than it's worth. This is exactly why your domain controllers need to actually be built correctly to begin with. Build them correctly. Have a separate partition exclusively set aside for the storage of system state backups. So the domain controllers that I build have always usually three partitions, one for C, one for D, one for E, and the E drive is exclusively set aside for Windows image backup, and in fact, I'll even set it up as a Windows image backup exclusive access partition, meaning that it's not even accessible to the operating system in normal viewing mode as E, right? You can't, like, browse the files there. So think about these things. You really don't have a solution until you've thought about these things and you've said, oh, yes, yes, I know what I'm doing with that. I have a solution for that. Let's touch on some more group policy things. Do your group policies follow best practices regarding being either computer or user policies, but not both in the same policy? This, again, is something that I see constantly being incorrectly done. And there's two pieces to this. You should have a policy that says, okay, I'm going to do user configs in this policy. And if you're going to do any computer configs, they really should be in a separate policy. And then for each one of these, for the user config policy, the computer config should be disabled. But yet I've rarely run into a situation where somebody's actually correctly disabled the computer config component. And the ramifications of that is that if you're not delivering any settings on the computer config, but yet it's enabled, well, this makes group policy processing slower than it needed to be. So you can see where that needs to be actually corrected. And that has to do with efficiency. Now, the other thing I see constantly, I have yet to look at a default domain controller policy or a default domain policy that's actually correctly constructed. It seems as though it's not clearly understood what should be done at the domain level, what should be done at the domain controller level, and that policies should be getting specified more so at the sub-OU level. So I'll give you the high-level recap of this. The only thing that should be appearing at the root level of Active Directory, at the root level of the domain, is the default domain policy. You need to resist the urge to make overt lots of changes to the default domain policy. Things that should be in there are like domain level security settings, master level of auditing settings, things like account lockout, or things that affect like logon hour restrictions, enforcement, things that affect user account security and authentication security pieces should be done at the default domain level. Now, at the default domain controller level, the Windows firewall policy for domain controllers should be specified. The Windows, the global Windows time infrastructure settings should be specified. Auto site coverage should be turned on in there. User configuration components should be disabled. You do not want any user config happening on your domain controllers. That's very bad. You need to make sure there are no abandoned SIDs appearing anywhere in the policy. And I bring this up because I just see it quite frequently. Abandoned SIDs are usually happening because inadvised, poorly advised former IT people at organizations were utilizing their accounts as service accounts instead of properly using service accounts. And then, of course, they get terminated and they're no longer with the organization. And they were silly enough to set up some software using their account. And then, of course, the software breaks when their account is terminated. The new IT manager looks at it and says, oh, well, I need to set up a service account, except, oh, nobody remembered to go look at the default domain controller policy and find out if there was abandoned SIDs in there. So they're left over. Yes. The fun that I see. So in the next show, I think it's worthwhile to do part three of this because there's really some good meat and potatoes here. And in the next show, I'm going to talk about manual domain controllers auditing, DHCP, and some Exchange auditing. So that's what I have for you in this show, and I certainly would appreciate your feedback. And if you have any specific questions about some specific problems that you're encountering, do email me at breakfastbites@gmail.com and let me know, and I'll do my best to answer your questions.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Saturday's Radio Theater broadcast takes us to the 1950s and the segregated South. A seat by